You got it, Dave. All right, Rich, very good. Yeah, just asking because of the, I also have a steam system in an old house. And the nice thing about the steam system is that there's no motors, pumps, high amperage, drawing devices. You do need power to operate the boiler, but the good news is you only need a few watts of power. So what I have done is I have been able to, in an emergency, okay, I can hook up my boiler as a self-contained unit, so to speak, you know, just like a lamp with has a plug on it. So I've made the boiler isolated from the rest of the electrical system in the house, and I basically just plug it into a computer UPS, which is simply an inverter and a couple of batteries. So I get my 110 volts out of the UPS, I plug the boiler in, and it fires right up nicely.
What are you using for the battery power to run that, and for how long could you run it? If your house was without power for a week, would you be able to run your furnace for a week? Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, I haven't really done, like, really, you know, precise scientific mathematical calculations, but I believe the unit, the boiler, requires maybe 5 watts or 6 watts of power to operate, so it doesn't need a lot of power, and obviously it depends on how big your batteries are. You know, the larger your capacity batteries, it's going to operate for a longer period of time. But what I have done with my system, I have outboarded the batteries to the UPS. So I have the ability to switch batteries in and out as needed. So for instance, if I deplete my two batteries, you know, that I'm using for, say, a week, and those batteries are now dead, I can easily disconnect those two batteries, put in two other batteries, and run it like that with fresh batteries.
KC1SAM.
Yeah, Sam recognized. Doug, the one disadvantage of what you've got is you're firing yours with 110, which means you're running let's call it a 24 volt to 110 volt inverter. And that inverter is being used under a very light load. And of that very light load, the inverter may be running at 20% efficiency. So you may be pouring a lot more power into your inverter than is really getting to your furnace. If you fed the 28 volts, your 110 volts going to your thermostat is going into a step-down transformer coming out with something like 24 volts. So if you were feeding the 24 volts directly to your furnace, it would require, I bet you, one half or one quarter of the amount of power, and you would therefore be able to do it for a much longer period of time. And with a little bit of testing, I'll bet you'll find out you could fire that with DC. It wouldn't even have to be a 60-cycle AC signal. Doug first, N2APG. I wonder if you'd consider that, Doug, K2RAW.
Okay, Dave, N2APG. I haven't considered it, but, you know, I have considered it. I've talked about it with some friends and stuff like that. It does require 24 volts AC. I don't know if it would work on 24 volts DC. That's a good question. If it would work on 24 volts DC, that would make a lot more sense, because now you would take the inverter out of the picture, and obviously the inverter is, you know, using power to do its thing. So that's a good a question, Dick.
We're start testing on one of those switches. You'll eventually find out. We're going to go over to Sam next. K1SAM, K2RAW, go ahead, Sam, and then we'll pick up the third person next.
KC1SAM. Yeah, actually, how you doing, Dave? We talked about this at times. I also use UPS systems, two of them. Mine are hooked up to banks of batteries. Each one's hooked up to four large storage batteries, and they run many things that I never lose. You know, your router, so you have internet connection. The internet stays up, TV, computer, everything. I run two of them for just about everything. I used to lose power here very, very frequently. And they will run. I ran a test once for 8 hours, and the voltage on the batteries didn't even drop at all. So they're pretty efficient. But the system works. I don't use it on a furnace because I don't have a furnace per se. This house came with electric heat, but so I use alternate sources. But the UPS is very steady, very dependable, and something like that. I don't know if you could use DC on it, but a phone call to the manufacturer would probably answer that question for you. But the UPS is excellent.
Yeah, for somebody to run an experiment with the actual valve that's fed the 24 volts to open up the gas, I think it wouldn't be a very elaborate experiment to find out whether or not that'll work on DC as well as AC. I think there's a 50-50 chance it will. Who's the third person who wanted to give his comment? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW. My name is Dick. I think there was another person who wanted to sign in with information on this subject. Who was that?
WA2VDH with a comment.
VDH? Go right ahead. You got it, John.
Yeah, just wanted to make a comment. Yeah, I have a Wild McLean gas-fired steam boiler. I don't have the problem with backup power. I have a Generac generator, but I did want to mention that I think the vent damper motor requires AC, and I know I think the ignition module on there that generates spark and also has the flame rod for sensing pilot ignition, I'm pretty sure that requires AC also. So I think the safest way is probably to just operate it through the UPS with AC. Go ahead.
Yeah, there are various designs of these furnaces. I'll bet you, Dave, your furnace has a pilot light and doesn't require a spark to initiate the flame. Is that true, Dave? Into APG, K2RIW. And maybe you don't have a damper motor that has to move either. You got it, Dave.
And 2APG. Okay, that's good information. I do have a pilot light, so I don't have electronic ignition. However, there is a damper, obviously, on the flue, and that, you know, again, uses some power, and I think he's right. It needs AC for that. So, it works. You know, I've tested it out, and it works fine. You know, when I put it on the inverter, whatever, and let it run, it fires right up, and the house is warm, and it works good. So, Rich, the GXM, it can be done pretty easily. The biggest thing you have to do, though, you know, you have to make sure that if you do power the boiler from alternate source of 110, you know, you have to make sure it's isolated from the rest of your electrical system.
The particular inverter you're using, Dave, there are inexpensive inverters that put out a 60-cycle square wave, and then there's a more elaborate kind of inverter that puts out a stepped square wave that comes closer to emulating a sine wave. Which kind of inverter are you using, Dave? Go ahead.
I'm pretty sure this one puts out a sine wave or something close to it. And you're right, you know, there's different types of, output signals. So you have to test it to see, you know, if it's going to work. I actually, before I use this particular, I'm using a computer UPS made by APC, the big company that makes, you know, all sorts of computer UPSs. But I used a less expensive inverter initially, and it wouldn't run, you know, the boiler. It wasn't, it probably put out some really, you know, lousy 110.
Yeah, there are some kinds of inverters that put out a square wave of 120 volts, whereas the step square wave does go to 167 volts peak with the middle step. And some computers, for instance, use simple rectification, and they require the 167 volts peak in order to get the right voltage to run all the voltage regulators within the power supply of the computer, for instance. So I guess this APC puts out the more quality sine wave. I'm going to turn it back over to Rich. Any further comments? WB2GXM, K2RIW. You've got it, Rich.
All very good information, gentlemen. Thank you. One follow-up question here. I've not examined the system physically, Is this something that I can do myself, or do I need to have an electrician come in, or in this case, HomeServe, which services the boiler? Do they have to do it?
Well, you've done it yourself, Dave, so you've got the best answer to that, in my opinion. Into APG, go ahead.
Well, I would tell Rich that if he wants to, you know, make sure it's done properly and up to code and all that stuff, then you would have a professional do it. And you would probably need a, you know, an official transfer switch, you know, something like that. That's the, you know, the best answer. I wouldn't tell him to do it himself unless he feels, you know, confident that he could do that without getting into trouble, because you can get into trouble. You know, if the power goes out and you hook up your inverter to, you know, you fire up your boiler and you electrocute a lineman down the block, you've got a problem.
That's extremely unlikely, Dave. You try to feed 110 volts back to the line that's feeding your house, because your particular pole pick transformer is probably feeding three houses. You've got the load of three houses connected to that transformer. The chances of your inverter backfeeding that system and putting enough voltage on that load is very unlikely. So lots of people worry about that, but it would take a comedy of all kinds of errors. You'd have to have, and all of the load of your house would have to be disconnected too. So to answer your question, Rich, the right solution is really a transfer switch, a switch that you flip between emergency mode and regular mode, which will, with its single pole, double pole, double throw function, will be disconnecting all of your furnace wiring from the household wiring and feeding it over to your auxiliary inverter that runs it during an emergency service. So a transfer relay is the elegant way of doing it. W2GXM, K2RIW, installed by a professional. It's going to cost you a grand to do it, in my opinion.
Okay, well, a grand is a grand. Anyway, I've got the big picture, and I thank you very much for the information. WB2GXM, end of subject.
A transfer relay is what really should be used if, for instance, you own a generator. Your own standby generator, to flip from emergency mode to regular mode, a transfer relay is the right way to do it. There's an amazing number of people who will, during a power failure, open up their main circuit breaker to the house, put the generator running in the backyard, and build one of these very dangerous cables that backfeeds the dryer, 220-volt dryer connector. There's a lot of ways that can go wrong, but a lot of people do it. And if you know what you're doing, you can get away with it. But there's a number of ways that you can end up with the case of the generator being 110 volts above ground, and you're standing in wet soil touching that generator when you were putting gas in it, if you know what I mean. And putting gas in it while it's running is also a dangerous procedure. So lots of people do that in a power failure. And if you're smart enough, you can get away with it. But you got to know what the risk factors are. If you have any further comments on all of the above, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and the TechNet. Okay, I think we've got down the list of everybody who signed in with questions or comments for the TechNet. Double-checking my list. I think it's time to go over to Roy, AC2GS, with the mailbag and the science talk, K2RIW. You got it, Roy. Ain't it nice that we don't have cracklies tonight, that we got a calm wind night?
Yes, Dick, you got to be thankful for nature being kind to us all. Unfortunately, no mailbag questions for tonight. No one sent me anything, but this gives me an excuse to remind people that if you have any mailbag questions, any technical questions for Dick, and you can't get on the repeater, or if you have any questions for Paul with the space report, or if you have any questions or topics or suggestions for puzzlers or what have you, or you want to refute anything that I said, hopefully with some references, The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. That's mailbag at, my call sign is alphacharlie2golfsierra.com. Everything that I talk about, for the most part, will have a link up on my link page, which you can find at roy.ac2gs.com. And we have this little chat room that we run. You can find it on the Limark pages, but you can also get there by just typing in chat.ac2gs.com. And for anyone who needs an audio feed, I usually supply one. You just point your browser to technet.ac2gs.com. So let me drop for a second, and I will offer you my little Pico puzzler for the night. Okay, my question for tonight is, what is the lowest ohmic value that a standard axial lead resistor comes in? Extra points if you can also tell the color code.
VDH would guess.
Yes, John.
I'm going to say 0.12 ohms, and it would be a brown, red, silver. I think the third band would be silver, which I think means divide by 100. Go ahead.
Okay, John, we'll put that in as your entry. Does anyone have any suggestions for any lower ohmic resistor available commercially?
N1 Whitey White.
Yes, Hank.
0 ohms would be my guess.
Would you like to go for the extra point question?
No, I don't remember.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, I was going to go with 0 as well. You know, they use it for like a filler or I guess like a jumper. You know, I have to get from point A to point B, but with, you know, no resistance. But that used to be, it was black, I think.
Yes, indeed. Hank and Paul got it. The lowest resistance is 0 ohms. It's basically a jumper, but it's a cosmetic resistor. They look just like the other resistors. They're your usual axial leads, but they probably just have a wire running through them instead of anything else. And the color code is usually a single black band. I have seen multiple black bands occasionally pop up, but the usual symbol for a 0 ohm resistor is a single black band.
JXM.
Yes, Rich.
What is the reason for a 0 ohm resistor?
Now, often you design, even with multi-layer circuits, you design sometimes circuits that require a jumper wire. And for whatever reason, aesthetically, or the machine is better capable of handling axial lead components rather than a straight piece of wire, you use the axial lead version.
Thank you.
AB2RSQ.
RSQ.
If the resistor has no resistance, how can it be called a resistor?
Thought someone would bring that up. Well, basically, it looks exactly like a resistor. It has a resistor's color code. I guess you could say that since it has no resistance, it's not a resistor. But if you go into a supply place and you're looking for an axial lead that's 0 ohms, you tend to have to look up resistor to find them.
Okay, thank you for that.
I mean, that came to mind as well. I try and think what people will answer and problems that I'll have. But, yeah, I could understand the semantic problem with that. But if you go to any parts supply and you look up resistors, and you'll find the value for 0.
let me ask a question about that. I understand that's how you kind of have to categorize it, but do these devices have wattage values?
That's interesting. The one with the single black line does not. Perhaps the multi-coded one has a band for the wattage setting. But usually when I remember looking at all kinds of different images for 0 ohms, it's a single black band, so I don't know how you would register the wattage for that.
Right. In theory, if there's zero resistance, there's not going to be any voltage drop, and therefore there shouldn't be any power dissipation. But, there has to be some limit to the amount of current you can pass this thing. So maybe a better question is, what's the current reading?
True, but the same goes. These things are not color-coded for any of that. So I assume that it is basically has the current capacity of the lead that's coming in and out of the, quote, resistor, end quote, because most likely what's going on is they just took that lead and wrapped it around an axial body of a resistor and put a black band on it.
Yep, understood. That's what I get for trying to reason things. But that might have been a question better left unasked. Thanks for the conversation.
Certainly fine, no problem. I like participation. Sometimes people don't think that I would kind of like questions. I like questions. It makes for a livelier conversation. Matter of fact, before I move on to my next topic, is not really something in the news. It's just based on a conversation I heard on the repeater this week that I thought might benefit from a little bit more introspection. But before I get to it, if anyone has any other questions or topics or stuff that they'd like to either ask, answer, or state, please feel free. Okay, I'll assume that no one has any particular topics. Well, earlier this week, there was a rather impromptu QSO, and they were kind of discussing all kinds of things. But to me, the most interesting topic they were discussing was regarding potable water management. There was a lot of talk of something called a water straw. Now, I can only assume that what they meant to be talking about was a commercial product called the Life Straw. Manufactured by a Swiss-based manufacturer. This item has been promoted as a economical, simple means to supply clean water to many third world water shortage areas. Now, Dick even discussed after Hurricane Maria, the devastation in Puerto Rico, and its inhabitants were forced to consume whatever water that they could find, no matter how contaminated. And the thought was that if only each citizen had a Life Straw, this problem would be solved. So I've looked into this technology of Life Straws, and although it's a lot better than nothing, they're not quite a panacea, not yet. But potable water is a very important thing for a person's survival. It's often said that some people can go for as long as 30 days without food, but no one can make it past about 3 days without fresh water. There are many ways of producing potable water. There is desalination of seawater. There is desiccant dehumidifiers. There are refrigerant dehumidifiers. There are condensation collectors. There are reverse osmosis systems. Now, most of these are rather complicated devices. They require frequent maintenance and replacement parts that are used up in the process. Some devices try to lessen the energy requirements by including some form of solar energy extraction schemes. The simplest, the most fail-proof and foolproof technology, though, would be a simple filtration method, and this is what the Life Straw uses. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, filters are a very commonplace object. Now, no doubt you've used one today to make your coffee. They're basically waterproof membranes with small openings to let small particles pass through while blocking larger objects. The filters come in many pore sizes. The Life Straw is usually about 8 inches long by 1.5 inches in diameter cylinder. with an opening in the top to place your mouth and another one at the bottom to place into the body of water. Your lungs provide the suction force that draws the filtered water into your mouth. The advertised pore size for the Life Straw is given as 0.2 microns, and their advertisement advises that this filter will remove nearly 100% of harmful bacteria, fungi, and parasites. Some other people throw out the percentage as more than 99%. For the life of me, I can't find any technical journal that's measured this or documented this. It seems like they just reprinted from Life Straw's marketing releases, but I don't know. I'll keep looking for legitimate third-party investigations. The Life Straw is rated to have a lifespan of 1,000 gallons before the pores become irreversibly clogged, and all the backflow force in the world will be unable to get it to work. If you wander through the Internet, you can find three different slants on this particular product. So often, they are press releases from charitable agencies that have organized the purchase and distribution of this product, and they often use the manufacturer's own press release to describe the product. Then you have these survivalists who often don't seem to actually try most of the stuff they buy. They just seem to buy a bunch of them and see their go bags and air raid bunkers and all over the place just in case. They seem to really love this product, although, again, I'm not quite sure if anyone's actually tried it there. Then there are hikers that actually use these things. They usually are hiking areas where the fresh water is far from man's tendency to throw garbage in the waterway. So I do not know if this is a thorough test of the technology in other environments like here in the wilds of Brooklyn. A problem I have is that the Life Straw says their filter is 0.2 micron pores, but there do exist harmful bacteria that can be as small as 0.02 microns in size. Even the manufacturer admits that it is ineffective in blocking any viruses, as well as any toxic material dissolved into the water. It's great for suspended solids, and it will make cloudy, muddy water turn crystal clear by the act of the owner sucking on that part of the straw. But I don't know if you really want to just drink any old clear water. Let me drop for a sec.
You see Toy S coming.
Hey, Bill, if you have a comment, that's fine. Otherwise, I'll be done with this in about 3-4 minutes. And then you can ask all the comments you want.
I can wait.
Keep it out. Well, anyway, there are lakes and rivers with very little dissolved toxic substances. So as long as there aren't any viruses to worry about, a Life Straw would work very well. And if that river is, but if that river is downstream from a nearby industry that flushes their byproducts, the Life Straw will be useless against many toxic substances. Now, the manufacturer of the Life Straw has considered this, and they include in some models an activated carbon filter as part of the device. The activated carbon device, though, has a much shorter lifespan than the Life Straw's filter. They rate it at about 25 gallons, but this really depends upon what you're filtering with it. And there's little indication of when the activated carbon might need to be swapped out. But it can reduce dissolved heavy metals and some volatile hydrocarbons to a degree. Some people out there on the Internet, though, have taken this additional filter as being almost magical and have tried to use it to purify things like seawater and even urine. I would strongly suggest not trying that. The Life Straw, even with the activated carbon filter, can't remove dissolved salts in seawater and most dissolved materials like urine or urea in your urine. Consuming seawater or urine with the best Life Straw would not prolong your life. It would most likely shorten it even further. So if you have access to a relatively clean, unpolluted water supply, a trip through something like a Life Straw would work remarkably well. But it ain't magic, and trying it on brackish water or bodies of water downstream from toxic runoffs will make your life problematic. In short, it's better than nothing. Often, but not always. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
N1YDY with a comment, but after the other gentleman, please.
Okay, over to you, Bill.
Just wanted to comment on two things. There was some pressurized canister technology for purifying water This was based on silicon wafer manufacturing techniques, like semiconductors. And basically, they're using the same techniques to cut filters, getting close to the point of being able to filter out viruses. I think somebody had an invention where they demonstrated it by actually taking water contaminated with fecal matter, running it through this pressurized canister, and then drinking the result. I'm sure I would not recommend that, but, you know, that's their level of confidence. The other thing is that in third world countries, there are, I think, pretty cheap solutions based on, you know, basically building small cement towers, filling them with sand, and running water through them. That seems cost-effective, and to use materials that are somewhat readily available in those areas. AC2IS.
Well, Bill, I agree with you. Matter of fact, I distinctly recall when I was in fifth grade, one of our science fair projects was just that kind of a filtration system. It's interesting what you say about the pressure filters. The problem probably is that the cost of manufacturing the filter, the cost of supplying a higher pressure to get objects through such small pores, and the lifespan of those filters probably would make them too expensive and not last that long, would be my guess. But I agree entirely, and matter of fact, it wowed people when we showed it to people in the fifth grade.
I'm shocked that you had access to that technology in the fifth grade. The size of cuts they're able to make in these materials nowadays are much smaller than they used to be. Like I said, they're getting around the virus size now. I'm not sure that commercial products bother going to that size because of pressure that might be required and the clogging that would result. But I think this filter was pretty reusable because you could, I think you could reverse the pressure in order to clear it out and then run it forward again to produce more clean filtered water. I think that's it. AC2IS.
Okay, I was alluding to your second example, the collection of sediment, sand and such. And you just run cloudy water through, we had jars of sand, basically, that was packed real tight, and it acted almost like a very nice filter. You put mud water off the top of this contraption, and out came reasonably clean water at the bottom. So that's what I was alluding to. As far as backflow, a lot of filters work like that, that you can kind of reverse the clogging the first time, the second time, the third time. But the problem is every time you backflow it, you find that it becomes a little bit less reversible. So I don't know how many cycles that you could use this type of filter with, but it's interesting. And if it were possible to kind of keep the price down and the technology around it, that it didn't require a separate pressurized system, then probably these people would love to incorporate it because they really don't like telling people that it won't protect them against viruses. One of the problems with fouled water from feces is that not only do you have to worry about viral and parasites, but you also have to worry about bacteria or parasites. You have to worry about viral infections as well. So they would like it if that was possible, but I think the technology is kind of overpriced for what they're aiming at. I don't know. Okay, I guess it's over to you, Hank.
Well, it's been a while, but I have some experience with overwater training for the airlines, and specifically with desalinization in life rafts. And we used a commercial version of a product that is still available for civilians. It's called Survivor 35. It was originally broadcast or advertised as producing 35 gallons per day of drinkable water. It turned out the number was a little bit less. I think it was 29 or 28 or something like that. there was a hand pump for reverse osmosis, and it was an expensive product. But the problem we discovered was that the product very quickly failed when there was any type of oil contamination in the water. So if you were not someplace out in the ocean, but you were simply someplace where some oil was on the surface of the ocean, such as a ditch plane might actually provide, that these things would in fact fail very quickly. The other thing that they fooled around with were the solar spills. And the problem they found with those, let me drop for a second, is that, again, you had issues with light compounds, benzene, kerosene, things that would condense out ahead of the water. So if you managed to make the condensate, you know, you heated up the water in a solar spill, the condensate would still have these types of things that would condense out first in the rinsate. And with that, I'll pass it back to you. Thanks, Roy.
Oh, thanks, Hank. Yeah, as I mentioned before, there are really two separate things going on here. The life straw is basically just purely a filtration system. I mean, you could say maybe when you put the activated carbon in, it does a little bit of purification, but there's usually either filtration or purification. And reverse osmosis or condensation or distillation or even dehumidifiers, desiccating or refrigerant dehumidifiers, are different ways of actually purifying and removing the dissolved salts and toxic material from seawater or other forms of water. But as I said before, they usually either require a great deal of maintenance or power or both. They're not terribly efficient. Matter of fact, recently, about a year or two ago, there was one of those crowdsourced things called a water seer or something that was supposed to be self-powering. The idea was that you took it to some poor third world village, and you banged it into the ground, and so the lower portion would be cool from the lower layers of the earth, and the upper collector would have the cold from below come up, and condensate would drip down, and you would produce gallons of water. Unfortunately, after they took the money, they figured out that none of that actually works. You'd probably have to be in a rainforest while it's raining in order to get the type of numbers that they suggested. And they basically just took a Korean a commercial dehumidifying unit and covered it up in their own brand and resold it at about 5 or 6 times the cost that you could buy one from Sears or wherever you could get them. So unfortunately, potable water has a bad history of con artists and flimflam people. There's a lot of different methods. Many of them are excellent methods, but they all have some weakness. And I just thought that would be useful information because people on the repeater were throwing condensation devices and calling them reverse osmosis devices and saying that there were special versions of these straws that you could use to drink salt water from the sea. So I just thought that might increase people's understanding. And we've discussed life straws in the past, Dick especially, and I thought it would be interesting to delve a little bit deeper into the technology involved.
Yeah, there's a version made by the Lifesaver company that looks like a jerry can, and that jerry can will supply 20,000 liters of cleared water. That's over 5,000 gallons. A little bit pricey, but boy, were those things really required during some of those storms where people were forced to drink very poor quality water. If the temperature is 100 degrees Fahrenheit, you've got to be evaporating water from your body in order not to become overheated. In order to be evaporating that water from your body, you've got to be putting water into your body. And if you've got nothing but muddy, yucky water in your neighborhood, which might be contaminated with all kinds of things, Had we passed out these objects to those people in those terrible areas, I think it would have, even though they were a bit pricey, I think a lot of lives could have been saved. Over to you, Roy, KQRIW.
Well, that might be true. What I just wanted to give people the concept of is that it, as much as I would like to say it's a panacea, if your problem is muddy, dirty water, these filters are great for that. If your problem is either muddy or clear waters that have materials that are somewhat toxic to human beings, it's ineffective. So you might have a better feeling than drinking muddy water. But if it's contaminated by different materials, it could be just as dangerous clear as when it was all muddy. That's all that I'm adding to the picture.
Question in one way, anyway.
Yes, Hank.
What was the name of the product that Dick said he had read about?
Lifesaver. If you Google the word Lifesaver and water filter, you'll find a whole series of products this company makes that looks awfully effective. They make various small versions for campers as well as this large jerry can version, which would feed a community for a month potable water, in my opinion. Over to you, K2RIW.
All right, thanks. Just wanted to look it up.
Are a bit on the expensive side. I'm looking at the jerry can version. That goes for about $190.
But if I was passing out water, to pass out bottles of water to people is a very temporary solution. You can't get anywhere near enough water that people can carry back home. Whereas if you hand them some of these Lifesaver products, they're very portable, and now you're giving them water for days, weeks, and months at a time, if you know what I mean, because they probably got water in their community, which is in terrible condition, and a way of filtering it is a lot nicer than trying to carry bottles of water, because the total amount of water your family needs for a month is not something you can easily carry, particularly if it's being passed out 10 miles away from where you live. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
I agree with you, Dick. I still remember the images. Well, even past the images of Puerto Rico and Hurricane Maria, there were places in New Jersey when they reported that the lead amounts in the water, in public utility water, was too high, and they started to hand out jugs of water. It was kind of a bureaucratic disaster. People didn't quite know how to arrange for delivering them or picking them up, and it was just a mess. So I agree with you. Just bringing in water is problematic. Probably it should be both things. Some people have access to a relatively clean source of water, and for them these filters will suffice. Other people, like in good old Brooklyn here, I do not think there is any open area of water that any filtration system could make palatable. I don't think it's here in Brooklyn. I might be wrong, but for the most part, it's either contaminated or it's brackish. And so you would need something a little bit better than a filtration system. But I'm sure that there are places that have crystal springs where it's probably very nice water.
K2RY.
Yes, David.
Good evening, Roy. How are you? I'm under the impression that New York City, Manhattan water, New York City water, is very good. It's very clean. But I still don't trust it. It doesn't quite taste right from the tap. So I had somebody install a four-tier water filter under my sink for drinking and for cooking, It comes out in a spout, but, I could imagine, you can get these filters, connected to water sources, and they produce a lot of water if you need it. Go ahead.
Again, we're talking about filtration for the most part. These are filters with particular small pores. pore sizes to limit bacteria and protozoan parasites and such. Sometimes it does include also, again, an activated carbon filter in which it removes some of the organic components and heavy metals. My understanding is that the New York City has very, very, very good water per se. I mean, I actually am not a particularly bottled water or filtered water user. I get my water from the tap. I do kind of put ice cubes in it and chill it a little bit, but otherwise, it's mostly standard water. And you know, it's a matter of taste. All waters have dissolved material in them. Very few people like the taste of distilled water. It tends to kind of, some people say, has a metallic taste or a lack of taste. And so there are dissolved calcium and magnesium salts in our water. And I don't know. I prefer it. It may be just a matter of taste. And, you know, there are some communities where the water is very hard or others where it's very, very soft and has a different flavor and taste and quality. You know, going back to the a story from a month or so ago, when they fracture the shield to get oil and gas reserves, very often they'll produce methane. They'll introduce methane into the groundwater, and every so often the tap water can actually get on fire when those two mix and come out your faucet. But otherwise, you know, as far as it comes to New York City, personally, I find the water quite acceptable.
Comment in one whitey white.
Thank.
For the gentleman who didn't like the taste of New York City water, there's a product also used by the airlines and manufactured by a company called General Ecology that most airliners use to filter the water from their tanks to the coffee makers and things that passengers would use. They're also available for in-home applications, and they tend to remove some of the taste of water that's been either distilled or coming out of a municipal system. I believe that the model is called a Seagull with some number afterwards, but General Ecology is a manufacturer, and it seems to work fairly well. Airlines love these things.
Okay, very good, Hank. Thank you. There's a lot of home water filter products out there for different purposes. If you're interested in espresso coffee, espresso machines heat the water very high, and if you use regular water, they tend to be hard. They have calcium deposits that are dissolved. They precipitate out into the espresso machine, and so there are ion exchange filters that exchange the calcium ions for other metals that are less likely to scale up in your espresso machine. So those are available. Activated carbon filtration systems are available. The different types of simple filtration membranes and such are available. So the market is all over the place. There are loads of different types of filters. If you don't like one, you can very well try another and another and another. Some of these go directly into the primary water supply, like they tap right into the espresso machine or your refrigerator, and others can be hooked up so that they feed your faucet.
Yeah, my filter is a restaurant filter. It has one tier for floss, one for carbon, one for ceramic, and one for coconut shells. It tastes pretty good. You know, I'm used to it, so I kind of like it.
Hey, I mean, it's perfectly reasonable to like a certain taste in your water, and if this supplies it at a reasonable cost, then more power to you.
QSL. Yeah, the filter man comes over once a year and services all my filters.
I mean, different companies have different ways of dealing with it. Some have people come in and do it. Others, you just buy new cartridges and screw the old ones out and screw the new ones in. There's a massive industry in water purification. You know, there's Pure, P-U-R, that sells a lot of these filters that just fit in pitchers. And the idea is you fill up the pitcher, and when you pour out your drink, it goes through the center filtration system. So there's a lot of technology, and it's being improved every year. You know, I haven't heard anyone complaining of any bad things happening with it. So if you find a filtration system that agrees with you as far as taste and the other qualities and cost, then, again, more power to you on that.
QSL, did you see that water bottle that has a filter built in? You put the water in, and you drink from a straw on the top of this water bottle, and the water goes through the filter?
A lot of these companies that make things like the Life Straw also make, Dick mentioned the Lifesaver, make a slightly different product in which they basically build a bottle around their straw, and you fill up the water in the bottle. Because one of the big problems, as I see it, and has been mentioned on the Internet, is that the original Life Straw, you have to supply your own container for fluid. Otherwise, you have to sit on your belly by the pond or the lake or something and put your head right next to the level of the water, because there's no way of reaching it otherwise. Some manufacturers design bottles where you just fill the bottle up with the pond water, stick the large cylinder straw or filter in the middle, and apply suction.
QSL, Roy, thank you for sharing. KG2RY.
W2HO.
Yes, WHO.
Yeah, hi, Roy, everybody. Roy, could you tell me, this is Howard here, could you tell me how the desalinization machine removes the salt from the water?
Well, desalination by itself is not a process. It's a umbrella term for removing salt from seawater. There are different methods that you can use. You can use electrolysis. You could use dialysis. You could use distillation. If you heat salt water and collect the water vapor and condense it down, you basically desalinated it. So there are different technologies that are used. Some nuclear reactors are promoted for their ability to operate at such high temperatures that they could be hooked together with a desalination system that principally works on distillation methods. But as I said, there's electricity-based ones, either in electrolysis or electrodialysis.
There's also reverse osmosis.
There's a lady that circumnavigated the world recently on a boat, Ham. And she, on her sailboat, she had a machine to desalinate the ocean water. I just was wondering if you knew what or what is generally used for a small vessel and the process that is used.
Howard, Hank reminded me. I didn't mention it because Hank was already talking about it, but reverse osmosis is another method, and that's probably the method that was used. The benefit of reverse osmosis is that you can package it relatively small. You have to apply pressure. Osmosis basically is a semi-permeable membrane. Then you put liquids with dissolved solutes in them. And normally osmosis would equalize the concentration of the water and the solute. So you have to apply external pressure to push the equilibrium the other way, and then you basically are pressuring the salty water through a semi-permeable membrane where the salt can't go through the channels. And that's how reverse osmosis works. You either have to apply your own manual pressure or supply something externally that produces the pressure. But that's probably what she was using. I mean, Hank, I'd be interested in Hank's opinion on this.
Sounds expensive.
It probably is expensive and has disposable semipermeable membrane. So they probably require maintenance, and you probably have to have extra supplies of the material. Because as Hank mentioned, if the semipermeable membrane is ruptured or in some way ruined, you have to be able to slide in a new one.
You know, the hand pump version requires physical effort to use, but you are doing what Roy talked about. You are, in fact, pressurizing one side of a membrane, and you're causing the water to move through the membrane while trapping the salts. The water that remains on the high-pressure side is called brine because it becomes much saltier, and it is dumped overboard, and then the water that is a product of the reverse osmotic system is actually called product, and the product is tapped off and tested, and there's a system for testing how pure the water is, and that's a method of checking the health of the membrane and whether or not the membrane should either be flushed or replaced. They have finite lives, and so in a sailboat, you'd probably find something that was DC powered. It's easier to generate DC power by use of sun and wind. There are small wind turbines called wind machines, and of course solar panels. You use a charge controller into a battery system, and then the battery is used to drive the DC pump. Hope that answers your question.
Answer your question, Howard.
Yes. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I caused you guys to double when Hank came back there, Roy. So thank you. I appreciate that. It's very interesting. I'll back over you, Roy. W2HO.
Howard, I noticed that, but thankfully I didn't go on too long, and I think most of the information I didn't double with Hank. So thank you very much, Hank, for that that information. I think all these things are sort of important to know. The other industrial methods for desalination, like electrolysis or electrodialysis, or even to an extent distillation, tends to be used. It's more expensive. It tends to be scaled up. The reverse osmosis lends itself to a small volume. So that's probably another factor in considering where you're going to find these types of different methods.
Can I add one more thing?
Oh, Hank.
Many of the Caribbean islands use reverse osmosis for their how they generate their drinking supplies, especially since tourism has outstripped the available natural water supplies in places like Curacao and Aruba in particular, which is quite arid, as you probably know. And reverse osmosis is scalable, but it's very expensive compared to other methods. Now, it works for Curacao because they have an energy source in terms of wind, and it works for Aruba because they have an energy source that's derived from their refinery process. They had a refinery there that the Shell Corporation used to run, and it's still used for, the heat of that is still used to help create the energy for reverse osmosis there.
Okay, that's very interesting. Thanks, Hank, again. Anyone with any other questions or comments on this subject before I move on to my next story? Okay, I'll take that as a no. Why is ice so slippery, you ask? Well, we're not going to play puzzler with this one. The answer to the question of why ice is slippery lies in a film of water that is generated by friction, one that is far thinner, actually, than expected and much more viscous than usual water through its resemblance to the snow cones of crushed ice we drink during the summer. This phenomenon was recently demonstrated by researchers whose study appeared in the Physical Review X on November 4th, 2019. The slippery nature of ice is generally attributed to the form